Hi, this is Hedvig Molesta, and you're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, your shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Hey, everybody. Welcome on back to Verbal Shenanigans Podcast. It's just me today. It's just me. Mike is off. Mike is off in Disney World on his honeymoon. Apparently, according to pictures, wearing his strange Mickey hat the entire week. So if he thinks he's escaping some criticism and some hard-hitting questions about that next week, He's got another thing coming. But hey, everybody who was just tuning in, we're on a lot of new platforms, so we might have some new listeners out there. You're tuning into Verbal Shenanigans. Verbal Shenanigans is a show. Weekly, we try to you know, one, kind of analyze what's going on in our lives. Two, play some, we play a lot of games, bits and whatnot. And three, we always have a very unique and interesting guest on the podcast. Tonight we have two, so you don't have to listen to me for that long. A couple weeks ago, we had Psycho Sid from the WWE. And go back and look at our catalog. There is a catalog. I don't know if you even call it a catalog when it's a podcast, a free podcast. But go back. We've had a lot of interesting people on the show. So please check us out. We are now on comingrightup.org. If you go there, we are on our weekly slot now, Wednesdays at noon. So when you're on your lunch break, you could pop that on, and we should be played on that. We're on the Discovery County Network, which is something brand new for us. And we are also on the BS Podcast Network. So other than your normal podcast platforms that you go and listen to your weekly podcast, we are on several other things out there on the information superhighway. So it's Friday. That's when I'm recording this anyway. I don't know when you're listening. End of the week, beautiful week, having a delicious, what am I drinking here? A Beta Imperial Pale Ale by the lovely brewers at Common Roots up in upstate New York there, up in the Adirondacks. Very excited that I was able to pick this up at Glen Falls. That's where it's at. Because I go on vacation up there every year, and we stop there, and now all of a sudden it's in the great state of New Jersey. So that's very exciting. But I got my workout in, deflated those man boobs. I hate talking about the gym. I work with a bunch of guys and know a bunch of guys that, you know, it's their life. In fact, my best friend posts the same stupid selfie basically weekly, like, hey, hashtag Mr. No Days Off, and he's like flexing and... God, it's just too easy not to make fun of, but been doing a real good job of keeping this old ginger body in shape here lately. But I got to tell you, the gym is like a zoo for people. You can find one of every type of person in the gym. All the weirdos go to the gym, especially like a gym like mine, $20. So all these gyms are $10, $15, $20. So you are able... You got to remember, people have no problem wasting $10, $15, $20. You waste $10 a day on crap if you go to a convenience store or stop in the morning for coffee and whatnot. You buy something here, buy something there. But the gym, man, people do not care about wasting money. And then the people that show up sometimes, you know, they might show up once, but you find characters of all sorts. Obviously, you got your big juice head. That's a given. Today, I was working out. I see a guy in a softball jersey, like a, you know, men's beer league kind of softball t-shirt jersey-esque kind of thing. And on the back, he's number 00. And obviously, that's a cool number, man. But unfortunately, the name on top said, zero fucks given. Yeah. So, obviously, he gives some. But really, dude, that's what you need to wear in the gym. That's, I mean, That is just, hey, look at me. I am so bad. Look at me, man. Did I just use bad? Like it was like 1992. But look at me. Like, I don't care. I don't care what you think of me. Meanwhile, you do. Okay. Then yesterday I saw the guy in the oxygen mask. These guys are my favorite. Yeah, you know, the elevation mask or whatever, the oxygen masks that to deprive them of oxygen so they get in shape. Now, it's always guys that look like they haven't worked out much. You know, this guy was running on the treadmill in his Bane mask. He looks exactly like Bane from Batman. It's just, are you kidding me? Is that the look you're going for? Is that really the look you're going for? Then there's another guy that comes in, another real weirdo. Old man comes in. He's like, he's got like that, who was that wrestler? The guy that ate the turnbuckles. George the Animal Steel body hair. So the arms are real furry. No manscaping on this guy. He's old school and he's proud. And, he comes in. He's got no hair on top. All but a little patch right where your neck fold. Your neck fold would be kind of, but it's not a patch. It is enough hair to get it into a ponytail. Now ponytail normally on the back of the head. This is probably 6 inches lower than a normal ponytail would be. We're talking about like on the neck, a little bit higher than where a necklace would sit, kind of where the base of the head meets the neck. And of course, what would be his legging of choice, if you will? It's jeans, cargo jeans. Always a shirt, always a sleeveless shirt. So there's always these guys. There's another woman there that is just such an Amazon. She's always deadlifting and grunting. Very intimidating woman. It's just, I like to go to the gym, but I don't make eye contact with anybody. I don't talk to anybody. Some guys like use it as like this social gathering. The other day I'm watching this kid, big moose looking kid. Looked like he played football, something like that. Young, maybe 18, 17, 18. Big, probably by my height, 6'3", 6'4", but really thick, you know? That's a delicious IPA, by the way. And he's standing on the bench. He loads, 45 plate after 45 plate after 45 plate onto the bench. I think there was four on each side. I'm like, wow, And it was a decline bench. So I'm like, oh, this kid's going to lift this. So I'm going through my routine, just going from different machines or different benches. And he still hasn't lifted yet, but he's walking around, kind of pacing around the bench. And he doesn't do anything. Now, I'm getting to the point where I'm almost 15, maybe 15 minutes I've been going, and he has not lifted it. And he's just kind of pacing around. Like, I get, like, if you're getting pumped up or whatever, but maybe a couple seconds, 30 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes max, and then give it an attempt. So, finally, it might have been his dad. An older guy comes by to, like, spot him. Kid comes. Kid puts up, does it three or four times, maybe four times, and that's it. That is it. He puts it on back on the, re-racks the weight, starts taking the 45s off, and leaves. Now, I get it. Impressive strength, for sure. So, 445s, what is that? 180. So, 180. It's, close to 400 pounds, something like that. It might be even more than that. But to do it three times and go home, he went down the stairs, which is towards the exit. So I don't know what else he was doing. Was he just waiting for that guy to spot him? But I don't know. Like, if I'm in the gym, I don't want to talk to a soul. Okay? I want to go in 45 minutes, hour max, and I am out of there. Now, the other day I had to, the pipes froze in the place I'm renting, the luxurious place that I'm renting. So I had no shower. So I figured I would go shower at the gym. That's an experience, too. That's an experience. Surprisingly, not as dirty as I thought. But there's always the three or four guys that, you get to. This is their hangout. Like, They might do maybe 15 minutes of working out, but it's that locker room that they're about. You know, they got bags. They got a full change of clothes. They're combing their hair. I mean, if you're combing, unless you're going right to work. Now, this was not people going right to work. This was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, combing your hair is a sign like, dude, do it when you get home. Do it when you get home, okay? You're sitting there combing your hair, looking good. Like, I literally, like, put sweatpants on, put my sandals on that I wore in the shower, and just got out of there. This is not a resort. I feel like if you're paying $20 for a gym, okay, it's a no-hangout zone. It's in, out, and done, okay? In, out, done. In, out, done, okay? But I don't know. It's just a zoo of people, a zoo. There's two of every kind. It's like Noah's Ark of weirdos. So like I said, speaking of weirdos, Berlo is not here today. I had a really interesting, good week of comedy, but very, very busy. And a couple good shows, a couple packed shows, you know, got to close out one or two. But I had 4 shows in a span of 5 days. And, you know, it's really interesting trying to balance a relationship, you know, a relationship with a real live woman and doing, you know, kind of pursuing the dream. Because here's the dream of comedy, right? There is no taking off. It's not booking a once a month gig. You know, you have to stay sharp. And you have to do these little gigs and get out there and network and get out there. That's how you get on shows. And obviously, the more you're on stage, the better you are. Now, you see the side of it all the time, like these older comics, they hate it, you know, like they're doing gigs that they don't have to. And I always said going into this, like, yeah, I want to be successful at it, but I never want to hate going up there. I never want to hate going on stage, no matter how bad the gig is. Even when a gig is really bad, like, oh boy, there's a camaraderie among the comics. Like, okay, well, you know, you go do yours in front of the 6 people, you know, 4 of them don't speak English and 1 is hammered calling out the whole time. There's sometimes a camaraderie about, okay, how bad it is, we're going to get through this. Now, so getting up is very important. Now, I want, you know, a lot of some of these successful comics, you know, they're headlining it's Friday, Saturday, but the rest of that week is either working their day job or really grinding, going out on the road. And a lot of them are single or failed marriages or failed relationships. And listen, I've already had a failed marriage, and the last thing I ever want to do is jeopardize that. So this week was not getting too personal, very hard to balance a relationship. And in fact, came down to a pretty, you know, involved conversation. My fiance was like, look, you know, I'm, you know, and she generally can be like a homebody. She usually doesn't mind being home. And sometimes your ego and your drive kind of ignores the fact that, hey, you know, every time I'm out on the road or I'm out doing a gig late, if she's not with me, these are the Friday, Saturday nights that you want to spend with the, you know, the person that you love and whatnot, and the person you want to spend your free time with. And that's generally when people's free time is. And, you know, when it's a gig and it's, hey, I got a Knights of Columbus gig, oh joy. So reality kind of hit where, you know, basically what it comes down to is I'm going to have to, we came to an agreement where there's like X amount of shows like that I'm going to try to do per month unless it's like a good opportunity or a club books me, but maybe to limit the amount of shows instead of taking absolutely everything or doing a percentage of the weekend rather than every weekend spot you can kind of get in. It's a real, you know, I feel that for any artist or anyone who is working off schedules from their loved one or whatnot. Now, some couples are amazing at making it work and then being away. But I have to imagine the entertainer's life of being away all the time. Very, very strenuous on a relationship. And obviously we hear all these entertainers divorced and second marriage, third marriage and whatnot. And I got to imagine that's a lot of it. is being away and not spending that pure quality time together. So that's not to say that I will be quitting comedy, because I really couldn't. It's the thing that comedy found me, and I don't know if I've ever really gotten into this on the podcast, and I will, and we'll get to our first guest here. When I was going through, I don't want to get too into my divorce. When I was going through my divorce, I was essentially left home at the house by myself for a very long, long, long period of time, over a year, trying to sell the house, get the house ready, trying to pay bills, working nonstop. And, you know, it gets pretty lonely when you're sitting there with your dog all the time, and that's it. And I had done comedy a little bit in college. I don't really count it as any valuable time or time served or whatnot. But I had done it for a little while, and it was always something I wanted to do. I remember telling my ex-girlfriend, like, oh, I'm going to do it. Before you know it, years and years and years and years and years go by. So when I was going through my divorce, it was, you know what? I got to go pursue this thing. And it was an outlet. It was an outlet for not only just getting out of the house, it was an outlet for getting some of those emotions out of your mouth into joke form, yes, but still, you know, going through and getting something off your chest. And the third thing, it provided a community of pretty good people. I met a lot of good people through the comedy community. So it really did. I don't like to be dramatic and say it saved my life, but it definitely put that love of creating and entertainment back into my life again. I was in bands for a long time and I loved it. I was committed, always went as deep as I possibly could. And comedy put that love of creating back in my life. I went through this period when I was very into video editing and shooting video. And, I always felt like stand up was my number one passion, but, very much learning. I guess these are growing pains of getting more, so successful, but getting more gigs and feature spots and being asked to go all over the place to do shows. So, you know, growing a little bit career-wise, if you will, but also, you know, finding that adjustment and that sweet spot as a family. You know, I like to have kids. Obviously, comedy's going to change a little bit, but you know, I also look at it as laying the brick and mortar, the foundation now. So I have access to spots when that time comes. So it was an interesting dynamic, and I don't think anybody was wrong. I just think it was something that had to be kind of hashed out and figured out. And we'll see how that turns up in the future here. All right, time to get to one of our guests. Okay, so I was put in contact with this musician, the trio, in Norway. Okay, so I think this is our first guest from Norway. And they are called I hope I'm not butchering her name because she's phenomenal. The Hedvig Malestad Trio. Okay, Hedvig Malestad. And they are a ripping trio. Do like a lot of almost like acid jazz, trippy hard rock, bluesy at points. I even said to her on the podcast, I get some Mars Volta in there. I get some Black Sabbath. There's a lot in it, and I really, so it's instrumental, all instrumental. And I got to do an interview with Hedvig, and she was a sweetheart, very interesting person. We talked a lot about the recording process of her album and the scene in Norway and whatnot. So, guys, without further ado, here is my interview with Hedvig Malestad.
Hello.
Hi, is this Hedvig?
Yes, finally.
Beautiful. This is Scott. How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Good to get in touch with you.
How is the connection?
You sound pretty good. Not bad for
all right?
Not bad for being halfway across the world.
Okay. Just let me know if the internet is not good enough, and I will move around in this flat to find a better place.
It sounds pretty good. Are you in Oslo right now?
Yes.
Yeah, this has to be. I think this is our first interview in Norway. So you are
really?
You're breaking the ice for us. So
yes.
You're representing Norway for us. You know, we've been trying to crack the Norway market, and we finally got it.
I'll show you a way in. Yeah.
So, it's, I don't want to butcher you. So, do I pronounce it Hedvig Malstad? Is that the correct way to say it?
Yeah, especially the first name was correct.
How do I pronounce this?
I don't know. Molestad?
Molestad.
Is that possible?
Molestad.
Yeah.
How's that?
Yeah, that's great.
That's great. So, first off, thanks for giving.
Are you sure you're not a Norwegian?
No.
You're not a Norwegian? That's just fooling me.
No, no. You know, maybe I have some in my DNA somewhere, but that's okay. That's about it. But first off, thanks for giving us a few minutes here. I guess we'll start with your new album that just dropped, what, the 18th of January? So about 3 weeks ago, about 4 weeks ago. Tell us about Smells Funny.
Well, it smells a little funny. Just one moment. Trond, det er så dårlig. Kan vi bytte plass? Eller kan jeg sitte her? Smells Funny, it's our fifth studio album.
Right.
And, well, what can I say?
I don't know.
It's
what,
still...
How's it different than the other albums?
Well, I was thinking about that, and it's, I don't think it's that much different, actually.
Right.
It's a... you know, it's a... I think we've done it pretty much the same way for all the records. And what was new this time was just... It's just a different studio, but the way we make the songs, it's pretty much the same, you know? Just trying to make... to figure out how we could turn cool riffs into even cooler and how we can... try to be just a little different direction from the last record we made.
Right. Well, let's talk about your actual style for people over here who don't know the band. Now, I was unaware of you. I was put in touch with you through Syndicate, and I've been listening for the last couple of weeks and really, really digging the sound. I mean, one, you guys are incredible musicians. Are you the type of guy, like, you know, your albums, they have a loose feel to them, like they can kind of go anywhere. You know, I don't know. There's some jazz in there. There's some experimental rock, some trippy stuff going on. Are you the guys, do you kind of show up with a riff and then just build off of one riff? Do you come with a whole song written and then show it to the band? How do you guys go about creating your music?
Yeah, that's an interesting way to start because there are so many different ways for these kind of bands, you know, instrumental bands, to make their songs. I think we are very little jammy. When very often I read in those people writing about us, they say, "Oh, and then it's a long jam," and I don't, you know, I don't recognize any of that because we kind of turn every little piece very much around before we make it into a song.
Okay. So are you primarily writing this on your own or are you coming in and presenting just an idea and then the band builds it?
You know, we kind of do all of those kinds of ways of making music. Sometimes in the beginning, the first album or the first two albums, then I made most of the music. But it was very, very clear that the more they contributed, the better the music became and the more interesting it became to play it.
Right.
And also they felt more connected to the band, like a band.
Correct.
So
yeah.
We have tried in a larger and larger, to a larger and larger degree, to collaborate more and more on this. But still, I think I'm still doing the main songwriting.
Mm-hmm.
But that could be of anything from a long structure, but I could also send away this is the main riff. Can somebody write
a
part,
right.
Or where would you take this?
So now if people were going to see you live, and as far as the songs from the album to the live performance, do you guys you try to keep it you know, kind of verbatim to the album, or is there a looseness where you explore on certain songs live? Do you change it up?
Yeah, some of the songs we play pretty much like they are, but you know, the solo parts are always a little different,
right?
And also the songs, they evolve for each time we play the song, it evolves. a little bit. So it, of course, it changes a little bit. But we don't. Most of the songs we try to make recognizable to the audience,
right?
Because we appreciate it ourselves when we go to concerts and can recognize the music actually. So
yeah, I mean, especially with an instrumental band, it's, you know, it's got to be both hard but also rewarding when people are rocking out just as hard to riffs, you know, rather than
really
catchy choruses and catchy verses and whatnot. How do you yeah, go ahead.
No, we really appreciate the communication with the audience, which is actually quite important to us. And not least from a, this is quite boring, but from a philosophical aspect, there is so much happening in this meeting. If they weren't there, we wouldn't play, you know. So this is where it all starts.
Right.
And they have so much to say in how the concert, how we perceive the concert and how we develop it and how they make us feel, which also backfires to the way we play actually.
No, go ahead.
I mean, if I play an intro of one of the most riffy songs that I know here in Norway they recognize, and I play an intro where I kind of hint to the riff and I can hear that they respond to that, that's really cool, you know.
Right. I mean, yeah, for sure. Now, let me ask you about recording. Like, I listen to your recordings and it has a, to me, it has an analog type sound, like a, almost, it sounds like tape or very vintagey kind of sound. It sounds like a live feel to it. How do you guys go about recording? Are you doing overdubs? Are you recording live just together? What is your recording technique?
You must have a very good ear because we have recorded on tape almost every one of them.
Okay.
and especially in the beginning, we were very, very, you know, we're not going to stitch anything together here. This is all going to be live and just one take. And even if it's a sour tone in the bass, we just have to leave it. And if I play a wrong note, then it's just there. And that's kind of the aesthetics that we appreciate, because we don't mean to be perfect, but we mean to be a kind of a true picture of what we are at the very moment that we record the music. And also we feel like a live band. We're not a studio band, which means that the songs are okay, but they don't become magic until it's
in front
until
of you.
There's something happening. Yeah, and that only happens in a live situation. So with that in mind, we wanted to keep it as live as possible.
Yeah, well, it definitely comes through that way.
That's very good.
Now, is it hard to get the amount of tape you need still these days, or is it, or like the studio provide all that?
No, they provide it. It's a little bit more expensive.
Right.
And also they have this, you record it to tape and then you record it, you know, digitally.
Digital, yeah.
So when we've finished one track, then we can just take it into the machine and mm-hmm. then use.
Right.
We don't keep
the masters. Yeah.
Yeah, we keep the masters, but we don't keep all the takes.
Oh, right.
No. Because we do 100 billion takes, and we only keep the ones.
Right. So let me ask you. Let's go back more towards your influences and your roots. Obviously, you have the ability to shred and go all over the place. And were you a classically trained musician, or do you play more by ear? And when did you pick up a guitar? Were you a piano player first? What is your background in music?
My father, he used to be a musician. But he put down his horn when he met my mother because he felt it was such a hard lifestyle. and he actually recorded with Jan Garbarek. He's a very famous saxophonist, Jan Garbarek, in the 70s. But he was very... I think that made him very clear that if I was going to choose music, I was going to choose it myself. So they put very little pressure on me to, you know, take music education. But it was still very present in my everyday life. There was a piano at home. My mother played the guitar. She also played the cornet. My father played the tiegelhorn. So I played the piano, but I started playing guitar when I was 10, and it was my mother's nylon strung guitar that she bought in Prague for, I mean, now it, then it was probably 20 years, but it was good. And they asked if I wanted to start it in this brass band, and I said no, hell no. And but they offered me this guitar teacher that was a little bit into jazz, and we worked a bit on chords that I found it very intriguing then, back then, because it was, he started out with some boring things that I wasn't very inspired by, but then he started with some chord things and told me to figure out where's the third, where's the fifth, where's the ninth, what happened to this fifth, is it big, mm-hmm. or is it small, you know. And so I learned that very early, and I kind of had a feeling that I knew the instrument very early. But then I didn't want to become a musician until I was in my 20s, actually.
Okay. Now, did you have any major, who are some of your major rock influences?
I think it's hard to analyze what has actually influenced me the most, because I've listened to so many different things.
Of course.
And of course, when I was a teenager, I listened to things that I hardly recognize it in the music that we make today, because then I listened a lot to grunge. I didn't meet hard rock until I was in my 20s, actually. I listened a lot to jazz before that, but when I met it, it made a huge impact on me. And also I still, you know, discover very, very basic rock music that people just raise their brows of, that I haven't heard. I think I was 24 before I heard Black Sabbath, you know.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember when I heard it the first time, the guy that showed me to it just shook his head and he said, I'm so jealous of all that music you haven't listened to yet.
Yeah.
So now I listened to a lot of great rock music very late, and I think that might be the reason for the trio sounding what it does.
Yeah.
Because I didn't burn out as a teenager on that music, you know, in the cell, in the basement with my friends. I was stuck in my room nibbling the strings. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I listened to a couple of your songs just before we got on today, and I was trying to sit there and kind of pick out things, and you know who I hear, and you do. I get everything from Black Sabbath to the Mars Volta to Sonic Youth at some points, and I just get a very, very blended sound, and it's very obvious that you're not going for any one particular sound, which is what I appreciate. Tell me about the working with the trio. Were you always going for a trio? Were you ever a bigger band? And was there ever any thought to having a lyricist or a vocalist? Or was it always just, I'm going instrumental from the beginning?
So those choices were actually there from the start. We are going to be a trio. And there was no intention on singing or having lyrics. But that wasn't something I thought, we're not going to have it. It was just, we play guitar and bass and drums, and I wanted to operate in a trio field as a guitarist, because there are so many opportunities
right
there. So when this started, it was in 2009, I was awarded some, you know, one of these prizes, jazz talent of the year, blah blah blah. But then what was very cool about the prize was that you got to hold an official concert on a very big festival here in Norway called the Molde, mm-hmm. International Jazz Festival. And then I wanted to, and these prizes, very many people get them, and then they just gather these great, great musicians, and there's a one-off concert, never ever done again.
Okay.
So that was when I was thinking, I want to make this a band that can last for more than this concert. And if it's going to last for more than this concert, I have to pick a few persons. And they must be really good, but they can't be too busy.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to play with Ivar. But, you know, but it's something, because then we also felt equal, I think, because then we were going to build this together. It was not kind of the newcoming picking from the top of the shelf the very best musicians. We were going to do this together, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I had heard Ivar play in his graduation concert because he went to this academy, and I was really struck by it, even though we had played on some occasion earlier. And Eleanor also plays on standards with, but that was our you know, starting point. Mm. And this was at the time where I was still in the academy, so it was natural for us to meet and play standards, which is very funny. We played Bill Evans tunes like Interplay, and I mean, you know, the Stan Getz and Chet Baker, Lion for Lions. It was really a little bit schizo. But we had to start somewhere to just figure out how are you actually playing. I don't know, because we haven't played that much together, and neither had they. But in that same set, we also had songs like, then we covered the Melvins, the Blood Witch.
Mm-hmm.
And then I brought some, and then I made some of the songs from the first album, The Shoot. And then we immediately played very, very differently. And that felt very more right, because we felt shitty playing that standard jazz, because we couldn't match anything ever done.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, have you... You know, you're going on a decade playing together and whatnot, multiple albums, and you've gotten to play, you know, all over the world at this point. You know, do you sit there and look back? Is it kind of surreal, or does it feel like it's just the beginning of where you guys are going with this thing?
No, it just feels like our work, actually.
Like work, because all right.
Yeah, you know, but I like my, you know, I love my work.
Right.
It's like it's just a way of living. That's a cliche, but
no,
you know, I don't think we see ourselves as potential pop stars. You know,
right.
We are just here on a mission, and that is to make as good music as we can and to spread it as good as we can. At least to people that are willing to put some effort into listening to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that doesn't mean that we have to play very, very, very many more concerts each year. It just means that we have to have a steady groove.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Now,
so I think when we talk about the life of our band, we talk like we're going to play when we are 80.
It's awesome. That's the way to look at it.
That's awesome. But if our bodies are still intact.
Oh, they will. That fresh Norwegian air will keep you young forever.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you something. We in America, we always used to see like festivals, giant festivals were always really, really, really big in Europe. And not so much in America. There were a couple here, but now in the last, I don't know, 5-10 years, you see them exploding, and the Bonnaroos and all these giant festivals. Are you guys a fan of playing festivals? Or are you more or do you get a better vibe when you're in like a smaller club feel, or do you enjoy both?
We really prefer both, and we prefer, because if we play big festivals, mm-hmm. we rarely play very late, you know.
Right.
Then they put it, because they feel we are kind of you know, experimental, so they put us very early. So then we get to an early gig, and we get to see so many good bands.
right.
So that's the fun thing with the big festivals and being a part of a, you know, a very big motion. But we fancy very much to come to very small places, which is ironically something that has increased with with the length of our lives. I mean, because when we are we released the first record, we just played the big cities, mm-hmm. or Oslo, Bergen, and Trondheim, and again and again.
Right.
But after this record, we have started to play a bit smaller places, and we really appreciate it, coming to these far off places where everybody in the audience are related, or they are neighbors, or you know.
Yeah.
And then we move on the next day, and we go to some place big and play to headbangers.
I guess
we really like the diversity of that.
Yeah, I guess that's what's also great about being a trio. You know, you could plop you on a a crate, basically, and you could fit and be just as awesome as playing a gigantic stage, you know.
And we don't need monitors because we have no vocals.
Yeah, no horn section to worry about, nothing, you know.
No, it's easier.
Now, I got to ask you, we were messaging like yesterday, trying to set up this actually led me to questions. So you were like, oh, putting the kids down, you know, we could do it. So what is it like being a mother? How many kids do you have? And what is it like being, like, do they look up to you like, oh, my God, mom can shred on the guitar? Like, or do they not even think twice about it? What is the dynamic there?
Well, they're not very big, these two children of mine.
Oh.
I have two daughters.
Okay.
And the oldest one is 4 years, so she's just...
just discovering.
She's recently started to capture... Yeah, or she just... I've been traveling all the time, you know, so she knows that I'm a musician. She mm-hmm. knows I play music. She's been to my... her father has taken her to my concerts. And she really wants to... And it's hard for her to understand that my job is nowhere physically.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So she's like, I really want to come with you to work someday.
Yeah.
And I've been very strict on not bringing them too much because it's loud music and it's late and it's a lot of traveling. So
yeah.
But I think they don't relate to that yet.
Is it hard to balance your travel schedule and a band schedule with being a mother too, or you find a happy groove there?
I think it might be harder for the ones that have to take care of the house when I'm not there.
Right.
But when they are small, of course there are some emotional aspects of this.
Mm-hmm.
But for me as a person, I'm very used to doing this, and I love it very, very much, and it makes me feel productive, and it makes me feel like I'm doing something important. And
for sure.
And as long as I can come home and not be away too much, you know, as long as that balance is good, then this is the perfect work.
Yeah. Now, I love, we've talked to so many great musicians on this show, and I love, you know, all different kinds, all overseas, classic musicians, people that are big in the 90s, 80s, whatever. I love to ask every musician with the advent of streaming music and the internet and social media, being able to, you know, have access to music from, like, I'm able to listen to you guys from Norway in 3 seconds on my phone and dive into every song you've ever made and, you know, really learn a band. But then I know that, you know, streaming really hurts as far as, you know, record sales and whatnot, but it does also be able to you to make new fans and connect with fans. Where do you stand with that? Has that really helped the band over the years, or does that force you guys to go play live more, even though I feel like your band probably would always play live, considering you yeah. are that live feel. But how do you feel about the Spotify streaming and the whatever iTunes streaming? Does it help you guys as a band?
Well, I think it's possible to have two thoughts in the mind talking about this as you presented, actually.
Yep.
Because if you fight this thing and is very judgmental on it, then it's hard to move on, actually. So we try to just... I think that if this music hadn't been able to spread the way that it does through the internet, it would be very hard for us to go those places that we have, considering that we are not a very, you know, commercial... a band with a big commercial aspect or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. So... to us, it's just I think we have reached more listeners through the internet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we would have been reached either way, but these days there are vinyl is very popular. We sell actually quite good vinyl because people also appreciate the physical aspect.
They do. It's something I thought was going away, and then before I know it, I have in the last 2 years, I bought more vinyl than I bought CDs for the 10 years yeah. before that. So,
yeah, and that is, of course, this is probably going to turn at some point as well. But for now, this makes us make our music the way we want to make it. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a format, in an analog way, and still people can either stream us or they can buy our music all over the world. So, I mean, I think it's just a benefit.
Right. So the new album came out, like I said, about 4 weeks, January 18th. Are you guys touring on that album yet? Are there any plans to get you guys over in the United States?
You know, we actually released this album in Norway in November already.
Okay.
Because then our label had this big 20 years anniversary festival-ish thing.
Gotcha.
At the place here in Oslo. Mm-hmm. So we toured this since mid-January.
Okay.
And we are going to do that until mid-March. And then there's a little stop and some festivals this summer, and then we're going on a tour in Europe in September, and then a new Norway tour in November.
Awesome.
Yeah, so that's great to be back in business.
Awesome. So maybe we'll get you over in New York or New Jersey one of these days.
I really hope that next year we are going to come over and play a little bit. You know, because for Norwegian, it's very expensive to come to United States and play because of the visa, actually.
Okay.
Because of the working visa. So, and also you have to, it's a lot of work as well to get that visa. We've been there once before only in 2014, then we played South by Southwest.
Oh, nice. Which nice. Yeah.
And we also played New Blue in New York on our way back.
That's great.
But we would so much like to come visit the States again and play, because we played with Earthless when they were in Europe some years ago, and they were like, you have to come to the West Coast and play with us.
That's great.
And we really wanted to do that. So I do really hope we fix something up for next year. But I don't think it will be until next year.
Oh, that's okay. Well, we'll keep our ears open, and hopefully when you guys come, we'll take a trip out there. Hedvig, I want to thank you so much for giving us a few minutes here. And really, good luck with the album. Good luck with the tour. And good luck with the band. I'm excited to hear what you guys keep doing.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for listening to this music so deeply that you have. And also for rescheduling our appointment.
No problem.
I was very kind.
All right. You know, just talking to someone like that makes me want to put the musician title back in my name, to get on the bass again, and to get on the guitar and drums with some friends and kind of make some music again. I'm kind of jealous, to be honest. But it was very cool to talk to him. Now, as I said, Mike's not here, but we have... we did conduct an interview before he left with a woman named Pat Cambyses, and she's a cave explorer. Now, I want to tell you, I told this on the podcast before, but for our new listeners, I had one cave, very funny cave experience in my life. I was in Boy Scouts about 15-ish years old, and we were going into this underground cave. You know, they're like, okay, wear a bathing suit. I don't know why they sound like a morning DJ, but and put on water shoes and whatnot. So we go down into the cave. There's about probably 9-10 of us and a couple adults. And we go down in the cave. We do our thing. It's pretty cool, but it's really tight. A lot of small spaces to crawl through and get through. And so right away, that's always a little unnerving and kind of like, all right, well, I hope we know how to get out of here. So as we're probably halfway through our cave experience, so the instructor hears thunder, getting panic-stricken, because obviously with thunder generally comes rain, and being in a cave underground, when rain comes, that means rain comes into cave. So he's like, we got to get out of here, so we got to move. The only way out is the other way, so we got to move. So we're moving, and he's starting to get a little panicked and whatnot, because I guess that cave kind of floods. And we get to the end, and we have to go underwater through a hole to get to the other side. And the hole is not big. I would say I'm doing with my hands right now. I'd say the hole is 3.5 feet wide, 3 feet wide, okay, and only maybe 2.5 feet tall. Small hole, like you can get through. But, you know, like in a panic state, so you also had to swim underwater to get to the hole and then pop out. So I guess in like a panic state, you know, it's even longer. So we go through water one at a time. But we happen to have a very fat scout who was kind of the nervous kind to begin with. And I'd like have to coach him to get through, and like he's panicking, going into full blown panic attack. Like, oh, I can't do it. And like they're trying to like he's go underwater for a second, and they pull him up because like he'd pop back like, no, I can't do it. And the instructor's getting more and more kind of anxious. And I mean, there's no amazing ending to this story. Like eventually he did do it, but yeah, getting the fat kid through the hole, not a fun time. So here's our interview. Me and Mike recorded this with Pat Cambyses. She's a cave explorer. She's also a cave mapper and has done things all over the world. So a very interesting interview. So here it is. All right, Mike. Once again, it is guest time.
Again?
Fine. It's my most look forward to time every week. Because that means I don't have to talk to you anymore.
That is true. I mean, that is a welcome departure from our banter, if you will.
I mean, how many times can you hear about our stupid shows and our dogs and everything else?
I can hear about dogs a little more. Can we do that?
No, that could be for your other podcast.
Oh, okay.
Today, I describe dogs that I like.
This is a lot of them. This is going to be a 25-parter.
Today's topic is fluffy yellow ones. I like fluffy yellow ones. I walk up to them often. Who we got?
Scott, we're going to be talking today with Pat Cambyses. She has a master's degree from Western Kentucky University. She's a faculty member there, and we're going to be talking to her about her years in cave exploration.
Cave exploration. I'm a cave explorer, too. You know that.
Yeah. I believe you almost drowned because of a chubby soccer player, if I recall the story.
Chubby Boy Scout, yes. Chubby Boy Scout,
yeah.
That was one of the scariest moments of my life, that's for sure.
All right, luckily, we can laugh about it now.
Let's get Pat on the line.
So Pat, I mean, cave exploration since 1974, just don't like the people on the ground, is that it?
Yes. So I guess my question to you is, how did you, like, pick me to call about caving?
It was, the thing about our show is we always just try to find different and interesting people, and sometimes we look at different different stories or backgrounds or something like that to try to find somebody. And just one day I went into cave exploration and came across your name and saw you had a history with it and figured we'd check with you.
Okay, fair enough.
He was following you into a cave one day and was like, that person would be perfect to talk to.
So obviously we'll have to go, where did this fascination start off with? Was it as a kid, or what made you go into this kind of field in geology?
Well, so I really didn't think about caving at all until I started dating this guy who is very much into caving, and like obsessively so. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm willing to try it once just to see what about it was so fascinating. And the crazy thing is that I pretty much got like instantly hooked by it. You know, and part of it had to do with it was a really, really cold day in January, like below freezing, and I don't like being cold. And this cave was nice and warm, and so I guess that was my first positive impression, is a nice warm place on a really cold day. Plus it was just cool. I mean, you know, being in this like secret landscape that a whole lot of people didn't know about, you know, that was really kind of cool and exciting. And I just sort of got
hooked on it immediately. Totally surprised the heck out of me.
Yeah, I mean, I look at your background on the what you said. You were raised on the south side of Chicago. I can't imagine there's too many caves to explore around there.
No, there's no caves on the south side of Chicago. As a matter of fact, when I lived on the south side of Chicago, what I was really into is music. And so, you know, I mean, I was like, I could have been a groupie for all I know, but I turned it into a caver instead. So go figure.
So your first cave experience, is it like done by through tour guide? Is it something you guys went and you just went with him?
Oh, no, it was a wild cave. It was meaning that it was not developed and it was just on some lady's farm in Missouri. And so there are many, many caves in southeast Missouri. Well, actually all over Missouri. And so I went on this trip with the idea of, yeah, well, you know, I'll check it out, see what it's like. And, you know, I just got captured by it. I mean, in this cave entrance, I was expecting, you know, like Mammoth Cave, where you walk into this big entrance. And really what it was like a little hole in the middle of a cow pasture. And it was smoking. It's not smoke, but steaming, because it was so cold outside and it was, you know, 56 degrees in the cave.
Jeez.
And so it was like, you know, nothing like I had ever expected. I was a total city girl, and here I am, like, climbing into this dark hole, you know, climbing on rocks, and I'd never done that before. And, you know, getting into this little crawl space, and boom, it opened up into this big room and lots of cave. And we spent probably about 6 hours running around in there, and they were just showing me the sights. And it's just a wild place. There's, you know, there's no one down there except us, and it was really cool.
So what kind of draw you to take it from just like a hobby to something that you do on like a full-time basis and go into study of?
It was never a hobby. It was always an obsession. But so, you know, I started out just as a recreational caver, as in I like to see a lot of caves. And if you do something long enough, your interest kind of changes, because otherwise you get bored doing the same thing, right, for years and years. And so pretty quickly, you know, I went from being sort of a casual cave explorer to, oh, now I want to find new cave and map caves. And that kept me pretty interested for like about 20 years. Went caving every weekend, made lots of cave maps, explored in lots of caves all over the world. And as I was making my maps, you know, one of the things, you know, you're always trying to do something innovative. And I started putting geology on my maps. And it just sort of, you know, captured my interest about not only, well, you know, how long is this cave and how deep is it? How many rooms are in here? It was more like, why is this cave even here? And that sort of got to be a different sort of obsession. I'm still obsessed with caves. It's just in a different way. And so studying them is kind of, you know, where I'm at right now. I still explore them. I still map them. But also that added thing of, you know, why is this here and how did this get here and, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah. It's sort of I've been caving for a really long time. So think about it, you know. Your interest in what you do changes over time.
Now doing your first caving in the 70s and now doing it still, is there a big difference in like the types of technology or equipment you have, or is it still pretty much basically the same process?
Well, you know, of course you have to have light,
right?
Being that caves are all pitch black and everything. And the technology for lights have changed a lot. So we used to cave with these miners' carbide lamps, which basically had a big flame on them. And so you cave with fire on your head. And it's just like, you know, coal miners. You could, you know, that's how you could see in the dark. And over time, you know, it went from carbide lamps being the most reliable source and electric not being so reliable, to now everybody caves with some kind of electric light or an LED, you know, rechargeable batteries. And so the light technology has vastly improved. The clothing is improved. You know, instead of, you know, having like cotton or wool long underwear, now you've got, you know, PVC, Patagonia, Cinchilla, whatever. There's all these great fabrics to keep you warm. And then also things like the climbing technology has definitely evolved a lot. So technology has changed a lot over the course of, well, since 1970s till now. Things are a lot different. And so it allows you to do things that you couldn't really do as easily back then.
Now, when you map a cave, what does this basically entail? It can't be just as simple as take a left and then it goes further down here. What kind of items do you put on there? Is it like what kind of different views or rivers, or what does that entail?
Well, when you map a cave, you know, you're making a map of the cave. And so the old school way, and this is changing quickly, but the old school way was that you had a fiberglass tape, a survey tape, and you had a set of instruments that would read your bearing and your inclination, and somebody would record those numbers and make a representative sketch of the cave. So you worked as a team, and it was like station to station, step by step by step by step. And what's changed now is that they have the instruments that you use now. It's just one instrument that takes all three of your readings. And so in that sense, it's made the mapping a little bit faster, maybe a lot faster. So basically it's just taking directions, angles, and notes and turning those into a cave map. And so you need, like, you know, you take different views of the cave too. Like you take a plan view, which is more of a, the plan view is the hardest one to do because it takes more conceptualizing of the cave and you put everything in symbols. And then you also take a cross-sectional view, which is just the shape of the passage, and a longitudinal view, which is a side view of the cave. And you put all those together and you make it into a cave map. And so you have this map that you can use to navigate in the cave, or you could use it, you know, for rescue purposes so that you know what all the obstacles are, or for science, or there's any number of reasons, right, you know, that maps get used for. But mapping caves is something that, you know, I did obsessively for about 25 years.
So
believe that.
What's like the longest like you've spent, not only just in one cave, or just like how far a journey into a cave has taken you? Like, give us an idea of like how deep you guys actually go, or how long you actually travel into these things.
It depends on what you're doing. And for me, the longest I've ever been underground is 10 days.
Wow.
And that was in a big cave in Mexico. And the reason why, you know, you don't spend 10 days underground for fun. It's the leading edge of exploration was 5 or 6 miles away from the entrance and about 1,000-1,200 meters, you know, deeper, over multiple obstacles, multiple rope drops and traverses. And so it took a long time to get to your destination. So as long as you're down there, you may as well spend several days down there to do what you need to do, because it's a great effort to get down there and it's a great effort to get out. So that's the longest like time I've spent underground. The longest distance I've been underground is actually the equivalent of a marathon.
Wow.
We were...
So what is hell like?
Oh, no, it's not at all like that. It was in a big lava tube in Hawaii.
Wow.
Wow.
And it's a 26-mile, from door to door, it's a 26-mile trip. And, you know, the fact that we knew we were doing a 26-mile trip was, like, the motivation to do it. So nobody ever just does these things lightly. There's always a reason that you do it.
Now, I recently did a vacation. I was over in, like, the Soda Caverns, and I was enjoying the stories they were telling how during Prohibition all the moonshiners would go down there and make alcohol to put out and everything. What's, like, some of the stuff that you have found that exploring there that you never thought in a million years you would see?
She's not going to tell you. She's not going to tell you the caves with where the booze is still there, Mike. Stop. Oh,
I really need some good wine. That's why I'm talking.
Well, you know, occasionally we still find stills in caves, and if they're active, you kind of like want to get away from there because that's somebody else's own thing. Occasionally, people grow cash crops in cave. That's more in Hawaii than around here, if you get my drift. But one thing that I didn't want to find in cave was that I was caving in Hawaii, and we were I'm caving in Haiti. That's where I wanted to talk about. And Haiti's had like a long political history. You know, your rulers were, you know, killing people and throwing them in caves and doing all sorts of crazy stuff. And so we were exploring a cave and we found some human bones in the entrance section. And we're like, oh, human bones in the entrance. And they weren't ancient bones either. They were like, you know, they weren't like prehistoric. And so a little bit farther from where the bones were was a big pit that went down into who knows what. And so my biggest fear was if we went down that pit, that we would find a big pile of human bones. And of course we didn't, but I mean, that whole time it was just like, oh my God, I hope that I don't see this. I hope we don't, you know, I hope that's not what this was. And what we did find at the bottom was a really huge pile of bat guano, which is bat poop.
Yeah.
And I was like, thank God it's bat poop and not anything else.
Probably the only person who said that statement out loud.
or one more, and it was also in Haiti. And this man was taking us to a cave on his property. And he's like, well, nobody's been in this cave for, you know, 20 years. And so he shows us the entrance, and we're like, are you going to come in? He's like, oh, no, I'm going to wait here. I'll wait for you guys. So we go into this cave. There's two of us, and we go in there, and we start mapping it. And what we find in there, we do find a human skeleton, like
jeez.
Everything there except the head was missing, and it still had clothes on it, and it was obviously female. And we're like, I wonder if this guy knows that this is in here or not. So we went and we continued mapping around it, and then we came out of the cave, and he's like, so how'd it go? And we're like, oh, it was great. He said, did you find anything interesting? And we're like, nope. Didn't find anything interesting. So we're pretty convinced that he knew that was there. And I don't know why he took us there. But when we were in there, we're like, oh, my God, what does this mean? Like, should we be worried? You know, anyway. You never know what you're going to bump into when you're caving.
No, obviously there's a good amount of, you know, if you want to call it danger or risk, and, you know, calculated risk that you guys take and do. What's the, like, someone getting into the hobby or like hearing this and saying, hey, that's, you know, that's pretty cool. I've always wanted to. What are like the is there like a checklist of major things you need to take care of, obviously, first? And then when you – like, what is the major risk of what you do going for 10 days or something like that? How does one kind of prepare for that?
Well, first of all, if you're going to do something like that, you need to be pretty fit. Yep. Because any cave that requires that you be in it for 10 days, we're talking – that's right. A lot of caving. Mm. But, I mean, just in general, you know, having – you want to have the right equipment because, you know, if your equipment doesn't work right, then, like, for instance, if your light goes out on you when you're in the cave, that's not cool to be in total darkness. you want to let somebody know that you're in there, because if they don't know and you have a problem, then, you know, the hope of anybody knowing where you are is kind of diminishing. And so we usually, you know, caving is a group activity. It's not really a solo thing, although we do solo things occasionally, but most of the time it's a group thing. And so as long as you're well equipped and you've got some experience and, you know, people know where you are, then as long as you don't do something really stupid, you should be okay.
Now, you've been all over the world doing this, Mexico, China, Greece. When you enter these different caves, do they... do they all have their own certain attributes where you can say, okay, this is like a North America versus a Europe or anything like that? And once you explore, Cave, out of curiosity, once you map it, does it give you any reason to go back to them one day, or is it just kind of once it's mapped, it's done for you?
Well, most of the time, when you map a cave, you have to go back multiple times. So when you're done, at least for me, I'm done. So I have no reason to continue to go back. I want to find another cave to map. So it's this, ever, you know, there's a never ending thing. It's like when you finish mapping something, then you want to go find and map something else. And when you finish that, you want to go find and map something else. And so, you know, and of course, your dream is to find something that never ends. That's your dream when you're dreaming it. But then when you find it and it's like, oh my God, this never ends. I'm going to be doing this for the rest of my life. Like trying to map and explore Mammoth Cave, which, you know, I mean, so far, nobody's really found the end of that cave. And so, you know that when you go in there, you're just not going to find the end. And then on one hand, it's exciting. And on the other hand, it's kind of, you know, depressing. It's like, I want closure. Let this thing be done.
You go in the one end, you come out the other where the guy's like, did you find that body in there yet?
Yeah, right.
Now, what you got it? You've is there a total number of caves you explore that you know offhand?
Well, off the top of my head, I don't really know that number, but I suspect that it's easily over 1,000.
Wow.
Which sounds like a lot, right? But that I've been doing it for a long time. But one of my caving friends just completed his 8,000th 50 cave. And he counts them, and he's been doing it. He's like in his mid-70s, and he's been doing it since he's a teenager, obsessively, more obsessively than most of us. And so to have done 8,000 plus caves
is ridiculous.
Amazing. It's ridiculous, yeah.
Now, let me ask you, you go on these trips, these large trips. Are these funded through groups, or is this all personal funding just as a hobby, or are you commissioned by someone to go do this? How does that work? She's like,
remember, no. It's not a hobby. It's an obsession.
Right.
So how does that work? Well, most of the time it works like it's all self-funded.
Right.
You want to go somewhere, you're like, okay, well, we're going to, you know, we got to pay the money to go there. Now, I've been on a number of trips that were funded. I've been to China a whole bunch of times because where I worked at the time when I was going to China, they had these collaborative research projects going. And so it was part of my job to go caving in China, believe it or not. But that's really the exception. That's not the rule. And I have been on a number of trips that were funded either by, it was National Geographic, or one crazy thing, one time this guy won the lottery in Ohio, and he always wanted to go on a caving expedition in China. So basically, he recruited 12 people, me being one of them,
nice.
And we all went to China for free. That was pretty cool. But most of the time, it's self-funded, most of the time.
You're a professor at Western Kentucky, or your instructor at Western Kentucky?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Just out of curiosity, when you have students that come in, what do you think is the one thing that kids kind of always underestimate or overestimate about cave exploration?
Oh, that's an interesting question. What they overestimate about it?
Or underestimate something where you teach them something and like, wow, I did not expect or I hadn't thought about that.
Well, being that I'm a cave mapper, and that sounds all cool and everything, you know, ooh, cave mapping, that sounds real sexy, right? Not really. But, so... It's for the people that, you know, I guess some people are surprised at how boring it is sometimes that you're in there collecting data and doing stuff. And you're like, oh, man, I didn't realize that I'd have to sit around and wait on this person. So it's not as exciting and like thrill seeking sometimes as people would think. Or on the other hand, it's like maybe like, whoa, way over the top. So it's kind of unpredictable.
Now, is there
and
any?
Usually,
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. No, you go ahead.
No, I was going to say, is there ever any like significant downtime on these things? Like, what do you do? Like, do you just like hang out sometimes, or is it all work? Like you're not playing like wiffle ball games and stuff like that in the cave, right?
Well, to me,
like,
it's
he's like, yes, we have tournaments.
Yes, we do. We play chess and cards and all that stuff. Well, to me, it's like it's not work at all. It's all fun.
Right.
And everybody gets their fun in weird ways, right? And so when I go caving, I typically am having a good time. Now, maybe at the time that it's happening, I might not be having a good time. But after it's over, we're always having a good time. You know, sometimes your best trips are the ones that you're absolutely miserable and you're in some nasty place and you say that you're never going to go back there again. And then once you get out of the cave, you're planning the next trip to go back to the same place. So it's all fun.
Are there any places that are on like your bucket list that you just striving to go to? Any continents or countries or any cave in particular?
Well, I have a very tiny, tiny bucket list because usually if I want to do something, I go do it. So I have a very long list. But believe it or not, the one place that I really want to go to is the Apostle Islands. Now, I've been to the Apostle Islands. You know where they are?
Off the top of my head, no.
They're in Wisconsin. It's like, you want to go to Wisconsin.
That's where all the apostles were originally from, right?
That's right, man. The apostles. I went there once a few years ago because the Apostle Islands, all these little islands, have these really, really cool sea caves on them. And I really love sea caves. And so the way that you get to them is you kayak to them. But right. Lake Superior, where the Apostle Islands are, is like the ocean in that it's pretty dang serious. And so the time that I was there, you could not put a kayak in the water because it was just like it was too dangerous. And so I've never been able to get back there. And so that's one place that I really, really want to go to, is to visit these little sea caves in the Apostle Islands.
I would have said the Bat Cave.
the Bat Cave?
Yeah. That exists, right? That's
the one head, with the big like guano pile in it, or
no,
the one with like, Batman. Real Batman, Bruce Wayne.
Oh, the Bat Cave. Oh well, that's like top secret, man. We're not allowed to tell you where the Bat Cave is.
No, that's why we brought you on. You were wondering why I found you.
Oh man, well. You know, you can't break me. I can't give you that information. We're very secretive about cave locations, you know. Anyway.
Well, Pat, we've had a good time talking to you about all your work that you've done. If there's anything anyway people want to get in contact with you or any projects you want to promote, where can they find out about it?
I mean, well, if they want to contact me, I work at Western Kentucky University. You guys found me, so I'm sure that anybody else can find me too. But we also have a caving organization, a national one called the National Speleological Society, or the NSS. And their website is real easy to find. It's just caves.org.
Wow.
And there's information about anything that you want, you know, like where's the closest caves, who are the closest people to go caving with. Now, they're not going to give you cave locations because people don't just give those out. You kind of have to earn the cave locations. But it's a good way to meet people and to learn something about how you explore caves and what caving has to offer. And so that's probably, I think, my best advice to give on that.
That's awesome. Pat, thanks so much for giving us a few minutes on the show here. We appreciate it. And good luck with your future cave explorations. And Real quick, you're from Chicago. Were you a Cubs fan or a White Sox fan?
Oh, man, White Sox. South side of Chicago, remember?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
I was going to, if you're a Cubs fan, I was going to ask you how you felt about finally getting over that hump a couple years ago.
But well, you know, even I thought that that was amazing, but, you know, I'm still White Sox. What can I say?
Well, maybe you'll get Bryce Harper or Manny Machado, they're saying. But, Pat, thanks so much for giving us a few minutes, and good luck.
Okay, you too. Thanks, you guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. I don't know where my story about the fat kid in the hole in the cave stands compared to hers, but you know, and consider us on even playing fields. We're very similar, you know.
Yeah, had a very Goonie-esque adventure, just like her.
Pat Cambyses. All right, so. I'm going to get out of here. I hope you guys enjoyed our two guests, Hedvig Malmsteen and Pat Cambyses. So go check them out. It's obviously two separate things. One is a sweet, heavy rock trio, I guess, if you will. And the other one is a cave explorer. So there's something for everyone. Guys, the show just keeps on rolling. There's a lot of places to check us out. So please, if you like this, comment, send us a message. Follow us on Twitter at VS Comedy or on Instagram at Verbal Shenanigans. So real quick, I will promote. Today was a cool day. Today, when I'm recording this, is the 15th. And two of our former guests released albums today on the same day. One of them, J.S. Sundara. Really soulful singer from Kenya. I really love his music, and I'm very excited. The full album is out. That is called Tales of America. So go check that out. Okay, really fascinating guy. And I think that was episode 223, right before the new year. Okay, and then John Fratelli of the Fratellis, he just put out an album called Bright Night Flowers. So another very cool album. If you like the Fratellis, you'll like this. It's a little different. So you got to go check both of their albums out. Both really cool guys and both deserving of some listens to their music. So with that, guys, life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back. Bye-bye.